One, two, three, four.
What is love? How do the narratives we internalize shape our understanding of relationships, intimacy, and family?
Laura Eason is an Emmy-nominated producer, screenwriter, and playwright. Currently, Laura is executive producer and showrunner of the Starz drama series Three Women. Her writing and producing credits for television include The Loudest Voice and four seasons of House of Cards. Laura's many plays include the critically acclaimed Sex with Strangers. She has also adapted many classic novels for the stage, including a highly successful version of Around the World in 80 Days. She has served as artistic director of Looking Glass Theater Company in Chicago, where she also acted, directed, and produced on upwards of 20 shows.
Laura Eason, welcome to the creative process.
Thank you, Mia. Thank you for having me.
So, you know, you're really a complete artist. I'm just reading about your career and just to see how you've come up through Chicago's wonderful theater scene and you matured as an artist instead of like jumping into television right out of college. Just tell us a little bit about that process and your creative journey.
Well, I didn't know that jumping into television right after college was something that one could really do. I grew up in Chicago, spent most of my childhood there. I did move in high school and lived in Colorado for a couple of years, but born and raised in Chicago and was just really focused on life there and didn't really think about having a big career on the national stage. Like, I really went and saw theater as a kid in Chicago, and that really was my dream, to be a theater artist in Chicago. So that was the path that I was on. And though I had friends that went to LA right out of school, for me, film and television had a big veil of mystery around it. I didn't know people in the industry. I didn't see a pathway. So for me, I could go to Steppenwolf, I could go to the Goodman and see these plays and see a potential future there. But for me, film and television was like, how does anyone do that? How does anyone get into that industry? And it's one of the reasons why now it's very important for me to mentor, like through the Writers Guild East and other development programs. I think there continues to be less so because you can Google everything. But it feels important to me to kind of dispel some of the mystery in terms of how one gets into film and television.
It's so important. And I believe that, you know, before we go into Three Women, that we should say that that is your first time showrunning. But I want to talk a little bit about your journey because I understand you had a bit of a mentorship too. How do you do it? How do you get it done? I mean, we have to demystify this. You were involved with Looking Glass Theater.
Yeah.
You also embodied all these different roles, which I think must serve you so well as a writer, director, and now showrunner.
I was very fortunate. I went to Northwestern, and there were a group of Northwestern students that had founded this theater company called Looking Glass Theater Company that was newish and up and coming when I got out of school. And there was a director who was a graduate student when I was an undergraduate named Mary Zimmerman, who's gone on to have this very illustrious career, Tony Award-winning director. She directs frequently at the Met all over the country. And she was doing her early direction at Northwestern when I was a student there. And I started working on all her early pieces. And she became a mentor for me in that she was really just forging her own path creatively. She was doing very visual work, very inspired by Pina Bausch and the dance theater movement at a time when Chicago theater was very much realism, Sam Shepard, in your face. So we were doing crazy performance art in the South Loop and neighborhoods where you'd get your car broken into, and that was just the way it went. And so I came out in my life as an artist in this incredibly creative environment in Chicago, making super exciting work. Rich Maxwell was doing early work in Chicago, has gone on to make incredible work all over the world. And there were just so many vibrant companies. And at Looking Glass, it was a company of our own making. So I was able to be an actor, which was the primary thing I did, but then found my way to playwriting, directing my own work, which was something I saw Mary did, which I was excited about. And a lot of my early work was very visual and had a very strong visual component. So being the director as well as the writer felt important for the holistic experience of what I was trying to do. And then I found my way to be artistic director of the company. I also played music. I had a band in Chicago for 5 years and played bass or wrote songs. And it was just incredibly creative and vibrant. And there was an opportunity because it was pre-social media days where nobody was really watching. You didn't feel like there were a million eyes on you all the time. So you were able to try something new, play a gig, and maybe it wasn't your best gig, but you learned something great, and then the next one was better. But you were able to try and fail and develop and succeed and build on that and continue to really grow and not feel like everything had to be excellent all the time because there was this tracking and this watching, which on the one hand, it's wonderful for promotion and exposure to be able to communicate now so easily. But I'm grateful that I was able to kind of learn and grow and fail and develop without feeling more in the spotlight than one does getting reviewed in the paper or having a few things online, but not having it be the sort of machine of constantly being seen. So I feel very lucky that I had the opportunity to do so many things with so many wonderful collaborators. And also as artistic director of Looking Glass, which I did for 6 years, I also developed a lot of other people's work. I produced my theater company's work and was able to support new writers, people who hadn't done it before. And all of that was really gratifying. I learned so much from being able to really be in the work of other writers in that way, of helping them develop their work or produce their work and be in that exchange and learn in moments when I thought, I don't think this is working and I want to have a conversation about it, and then really digging in on what their intention was and what they were trying to do and having a revelation that I was completely wrong and that I wasn't seeing them enough. And that also is a really important lesson of not being too entrenched in my own position or point of view, but to really be open in collaboration. I could talk forever. What a wonderful experience it was to be able to come up in Chicago at that period of time and also be inspired. There were like 200 storefront companies, and you could go every night of the week and see a new piece of theater that someone was putting together in all kinds of spaces. And it was just so enlivening to be such a part of a creative moment that was happening all over the city.
Oh, yeah. It's a great theater scene, as I understand, and also Northwestern in terms of nurturing so many talents that we see in theater and television and film.
The work that I did in the theater prepared me to write for television in ways I really didn't anticipate. Particularly the work I've done as a playwright was very split between original work and adaptation. And being in a writer's room for the first time and understanding that the job was to try and match the voice of the show or the voice of the showrunner, I really had the revelation of, oh, this is adaptation. I'm trying to match the voice and I have to bring my full self and all of my ideas. But it felt very analogous to what I had done in adaptation. And I didn't expect that. And it was really helpful to have had that experience going into television writing.
Yeah, and it's so wonderful how you're already so open to this collaborative process. And then you get, House of Cards is just taking off. You've brought in for, what was it, 4 seasons from season 2 to 4?
Yes, that's exactly right. Season 2 to season 5, yeah.
So the birth of streaming, really, of a great talent. And just what was that like?
I mean, it was a crazy ride. It was my first interview to staff on a television show. I had only recently moved from a boutique agency in New York that was only theater to a larger agency that also had film and television and big representation in LA. I'm based in New York, I should say, and I've always been based in New York. And so I had thought my life would be New York theater. That's the reason I really moved here. And because my husband is a theater actor here in New York, and I wasn't going to move to LA because of that, I just didn't know if film and television was in the cards. So when I made the shift, it was a great opportunity to meet on a show. And it was run by Bo Willimon, who was a playwright, TV writer, but came from the theater and really valued playwrights and what they can bring. But season 1 hadn't dropped yet. So I had this meeting where it was like, it's this crazy new model. They're going to drop the show. We have no idea if it's going to work, if anyone's going to watch it. So I met Beau, and he had read a play of mine that he felt like the characters and what I was exploring in that play, which is called Sex with Strangers, were aspects of it that felt very applicable to the dynamic of the central couple in House of Cards. And we hit it off, and he invited me to be a part of the season two room, but it really was my first meeting ever with the showrunner. So it was a fast and furious entrance. I didn't have to be in the trenches for a long time trying to break in. I was incredibly fortunate. But when we started for season one hadn't dropped yet. I think we were about a month in the room before season one dropped and then became this, really. It was so popular. And that was a wild ride to be on. Very luckily, season two was as well received as season one, and three also did really well. So it was, you know, a bit of a huge relief, but it was just incredible to be a part of something that really became part of the zeitgeist. I think it's a very rare experience to be part of something that really permeates culture in that way. So it was a very unique experience, and it was fun to be like at play dates with my daughter and be talking to the other parents, and they'd, you know, talk about what we did. And after being in the theater for so many years where people are like, well, good luck, you know, they feel kind of sorry for you, like worried for your future because it's so hard to make it as a playwright, to be able to say like, oh, I work on this TV show, and to have people have heard of it and be excited about it was a very fun moment.
No, indeed. And I mean, we can talk also later about how streaming has evolved. But that was this period, and there's obviously excellent things coming out. Three Women is one of them. There's so much great writing there. You also just mentioned briefly your play, A Sex with Strangers, mm-hmm. but we should say that this has been hugely successful, performed all over America and internationally.
Yeah, it was just in Taiwan, actually, in translation. Wow. In Taiwan, which was exciting. Yeah.
So to have that kind of imprint that really captures the imagination. So we see from that the seeds, which that's like a two-handed dance, really. But a lot of the dynamics we see within the relationship, as you say, within House of Cards. So I can see that quality that would have drawn them to your voice. But also even going into Three Women, there's a little bit of that dynamic with the relationship of Sloane with her husband. You know, so we can see the roots and what might have drawn Lisa Tadeo, who wrote the original book, Three Women, why she might have been drawn. There's other things that we can see in your other writing and projects, but there seems like a lot of synergy between your previous.
Yes, I think reading that, I think, was helpful for her to see how I would make a connection to the show and to the characters, for sure.
Yeah, exactly, because she didn't have that experience. I know it was your first time showrunning, but you've had the television experience, so being able to put her story in her hands, and also because you had, we don't want to skip over your previous projects, The Loudest Voice, which was, again, a story where the writer, maybe you should give the summary of this, Lisa in Three Women is a character now in the television adaptation Three Women.
Yes.
And The Loudest Voice also involved the writer who featured in the story.
Yes. So that is a book about Roger Ailes and the building of Fox News and the subsequent downfall of Roger Ailes when his sexual harassment of Gretchen Carlson was exposed. And Gabe Sherman, who's a journalist and screenwriter, he was adapting the book. The show was run by Alex Metcalf and Tom McCarthy, but Gabe was in the room and a producer on the show, and became a character in the show. So there were things that became then applicable to how we approached Three Women. But I had a really wonderful opportunity working with Gabe as a writer and a writer of the book in the writer's room.
And from that, I mean, we go from House of Cards, which you see a certain amount of agency with the female characters in that. But those were, let's say, male stories in terms of like the male gaze, you know? And the power dynamics described in those shows is very different to the vibe that we have in Three Women. Well, we should call it Four Women because...
Yeah.
But really, the three central women in that, you really unfold, I like the treatment of time, the time that you give to discuss these stories around female desire and intimacy and, you know, what is love? All these women are finding their way towards it. They have these secrets that they think kind of make them stronger, but they're finding their way to tell their story and finding their voice in different ways.
Three Women is based on Lisa Tadeo's New York Times bestselling nonfiction book, and I was brought on to supervise the pilot before the pilot was written. It was always the plan that Lisa would be very, very involved in the adaptation. She was going to write the pilot, be an executive producer, and not all novelists obviously are that involved, but this was something that was really foundational to how the adaptation was conceived. So when I came on to work with Lisa, we started before the pilot was written and talked about how she wrote the book and her process. And it became clear to me very early on, which was something Lisa also had a notion of, that the telling, the how of writing the book was as compelling to me. It had its own very strong narrative that was on par with the other stories in the book, in that it was really so woven into how she got these women to be so open with her and share so much of their inner lives with her. So very early on, we made the choice that we wanted a character based on Lisa, not Lisa specifically. We name her Gia. So there's a lot of her story that is informed by Lisa's real story and the real love story with her husband. But also we gave her pseudonyms so we could open it up, because Lisa was very open and we both were really interested in allowing the themes of the show and the needs of the show to guide what we did with the Gia character over the course of the season.
Yeah, no, I think it's very well, because otherwise these women don't have a connection. It's set in different parts of the country.
Correct.
You know, she travels, she has this van, she goes around. So I don't want to just call her a glue, but otherwise their stories would be just sort of floating and then you'd have to have them meet or something, but they meet through her.
Yeah. So I think one of the things that can happen with that is when you have characters that aren't related, you kind of gather them in the episodes under a theme or an event that they're all sharing. They're all at a wedding, or it's all about, you know, this particular theme for this episode. And we thought it was going to flatten out the narrative. So having Gia connect them, I think, helped that. But we also made the choice to do standalone episodes because we wanted to really preserve their specificity as characters and not get into that, like, well, this is the theme of the episode and they all have to adhere to that. So that was really important, keeping the specificity and allowing Gia also, though, to have her own story. So she's not just the glue, but she has her own love story and her own arc of coming into her own desire that ends up becoming sort of the emotional backbone of the show. So it has its own integrity as a story, because we definitely didn't want to do just the journalist with the pencil hovering over the notepad saying, you know, tell me more. It really needed to be a story that had its own beginning, middle, end, and strength to be able to stand on its own.
And I think that Shailene Woodley is quite powerful. She's such an emotional face,
yes.
You know, not like, oh, crying all the time, but she's just very emotional.
Yeah.
So we can see her mature and find out what's important to her through these other women and through her own story.
Yeah.
And talking about the weaving together around a theme, like there is, if I don't think it's a spoiler, in one of the episodes you have the different women and they're having like an intimate encounter.
Yes.
Sex, you know.
Yes.
And it's a wordless thing, but you can really see, because each of them has a different idea of like what love means to them, what intimacy means to them. You, in talking about the standalone episodes, wrote, I believe you concentrated on Maggie's
yes.
story, which is a young woman's story. So she has these kind of idealized notions. And then another is Lena, who barely has sex, you know, in her relationship. Then Sloane has an abundance
yes.
sex with her husband and
yes.
others in
yes.
an open marriage that, you know, that's something we can't all experience. But so it's interesting then as you weave them together and you see they're still all searching for love, but all in different ways. And I thought that was beautifully done. But just to go into the story, why you chose to write Maggie's story. I mean, I know that your fingerprints are all
yeah.
over all the episodes,
yeah.
but that was the particular thread you focused in on.
Yes. In reading the book, I loved all of the women and had aspects of their stories that were resonant. But for me, Maggie was really the character that I responded to and connected to most deeply. And I spoke about this before. It's a very common experience. But I had moved from Chicago after my freshman year of high school and moved to outside of Denver, Colorado, and had no friends, didn't know anyone, had really left a beautiful group of friends and community in Chicago. And there were two male teachers who approached me in ways that were really inappropriate, that in retrospect, I know were signs of early grooming. And that experience really stayed with me. And in reading Maggie's story, I just felt so much empathy for her, because I just feel like it so easily could have been me. You know, these were young, charismatic teachers, and I was really lost and alone. And it just would have been so easy to have fallen into a situation like Maggie did. And then to see how incredibly brave she was, so inspired by her bravery and how she came forward as an adult to name her teacher as having been abusive. And so I felt connected to her because of that experience that had small echoes of my own, although obviously my experience was very different from what she went through, and then just feeling so incredibly inspired by her and her bravery. So it was those two things that really connected me to her in a really deep way, and I just felt very fortunate to be able to write the bulk of her story, the TV version.
Yeah, and it's really important because all these women have this certain level of shame, even with, you know, Sloane, who's quite empowered. And mm-hmm. I don't know if shame is the word for her, but there are different stages of finding their voice or what's important to them. You really take on these uncomfortable truths that can be difficult. It can be painful to watch. If these are things that we experienced when we were young and finding ourselves and didn't know any better or easily influenced, if you're being groomed, you can be told, don't tell this secret, all this kind of complicity, and then you just want to put it behind you. Mm-hmm. So all these women have this something, or if your husband, like in the case of Lena, isn't touching you, you know, there's a kind of affection, but it's almost not a husband and wife. It's something else. It's like an arrangement, mm-hmm. let's say. You know, and that's an uncomfortable truth to say, because you feel like so unattractive. And she's a beautiful woman, but you can start to second guess yourself. So I think that I'm very much interested in art for art's sake, but also watching this, I think, would be empowering for women and also maybe men, because there's nuance in the way that men's stories are told, to feel that you're not alone.
Yes.
Like others have experienced this.
Yeah, that was one of our big hopes with the adaptation. That's very much what we hope people will take away from the experience, is that they don't feel quite so alone. And I think that one of the things that was so powerful about the book is women were reading and able to experience and step into the inner lives of these women. And also to show that a housewife in Indiana who isn't being kissed, the young woman who is taken advantage of by and abused by her teacher, who now is speaking up for herself, but she's in North Dakota and she's a waitress who works at Perkins, that these women deserve to be heard and that they count and their stories count and matter as much as anybody else's. And I think that's something else that the show is saying to the women that are watching, is that your life matters. You don't have to be some aspirational, gorgeous person, although Sloane absolutely is that character. So there's someone for beautiful, aspirational women out in the world as well. But for the other women that are living in the Midwest and having struggles and feeling like, who is seeing me and do I matter? Hopefully the mirror of Lena and the mirror of Maggie will really help them not feel so alone and to know that their stories are really important and really matter.
Yeah, that's something right at the beginning when Gia begins on her journey, that she asks herself, why did she choose these women? And she didn't just pick randomly three people. It was that they weren't people who wanted to be watched. You talk about growing up during a time of social media. This is, again, a little bit before social media. But these stories, these women needed to be seen.
Yeah.
And I think that that's important to bear witness to that. And, you know, it's interesting because, yes, they are so different, these women. And another thing you addressed is aspirations. But their idea of what love is that has been in some way formed by these some like fairy tale, like the Twilight books or Princess Bride, or we hear music like A Sunday Kind of Love. You know, all of them have this, there is something in their mind. And we all have this,
yes.
You know? No matter how street smart we are, there is something. Women, maybe more so than men, I think we have this idea of the romantic love in our DNA somewhere.
Yeah.
So how does that form, you know, the partners we choose, the people, the relationships we develop?
Yes. And that was something we talked about a lot, and we're excited to explore the way these narratives, these stories in pop culture, these movies can really influence the way we think our lives should look. And I don't think we come down on one side or the other, but I think show both how sometimes it can lead you astray. It can lead you down a path. With the Maggie story, I think there was this forbidden love aspect to the Twilight story that was used to kind of justify what the teacher was doing, kind of utilized that to take advantage of her. And in that case, I think that narrative was used in a destructive way. But then with Princess Bride, it allows Lena to fantasize and to imagine something better than what she had, or to recapture something that she had in her younger days with Aiden, who was her high school sweetheart and who she believes is the love of her life. So in that instance, it is a fairy tale, but I think it also helps ignite in her the desire for more, and that she does deserve more, and that there is the hope of more out in the world for her. So I think it was so true what you're saying about we all have these narratives and these stories that we've internalized, and it was to dramatize both the dark and the light of what that relationship to those stories can look like was something we were really excited to do in the show.
Well, definitely. I think that the arts, and you can perhaps share your reflections on the importance of the arts, but is to allow us, we have this one life, I believe very strongly, like we have this one life that we're given, we should try to do as much as we can with it. But then through the arts, these are ways of having many lives and also not having to make some mistakes, being able to watch the mistakes that others make or experience the intensities of those dramas without having to bring that into our lives.
Yeah.
So maybe share your reflections on the importance of the arts and why you decided to make a life there.
I think for exactly this reason you're circling around. I think we're in an age where there is a lot of self-reflection about who am I and what are my strong opinions, and let me define everything about myself in this very strong, loud way. But for me, I'm equally interested in the other and other people and the ability, as you say, to live many lives through the arts, both in terms of watching other stories and getting to step into other people's shoes and experience and be in rooms that you would never be in otherwise, but also as a writer to be able to inhabit the heart and the headspace of someone that's very different than me. It just feels like the greatest gift. I feel like I'm getting to live more than my one singular life, and what could be more incredible than that, to have an expansive human experience. So for me, the arts have always been foundational to every day of my life. I grew up in a household where the arts were fundamental. It's just something that was part of, you know, every day. My dad was a businessman, a manager at a company, and my mom did hospital administration. They were not artists, but they loved the arts. And so we went every weekend, we went to the theater, to the symphony, and we were very middle class. We would sit in the way, way, way up cheap seats at the symphony, but we were there. And my parents had favorite artists that they love, and we didn't have original work, but we had prints, you know, or posters of the artists that they love. So it was always part of who I was, and it was always about being curious. And my parents really instilled in me an interest in the other person and listening as hard as you're talking, and probably ideally listening more than you're talking. And I think that's what the arts does for us. It allows us to listen to the inner lives of others. And that is a gift.
Yeah, it's true. And it allows us to peel back those uncomfortable truths we don't always get to ask, but we can watch that in a drama, in a meaningful book or play or a television And I think that's really important. It's interesting that your parents came up through business or management, but this is the other unsung aspect of the arts. And I'm sure you know this on a daily basis as a showrunner, artistic director. You know, there's a lot of management. There's a lot of logistics in that.
You're so right.
No,
yes, we talk a lot about the art and the beautiful moment when you're actually in rehearsal or you're making something or you're on set and you're shooting. But there are so many logistics that go into that. And there's so much prep and so much you have to do to get to that beautiful moment of creation. And a lot of it is meetings and work and figuring in logistics and making sure everything's where it needs to be, and then managing people and taking care of people and making sure they have what they need so they can do their best work. And yeah, for boring parts than one thinks from the outside, but it requires the maybe not so exciting meetings and work to get you to that moment of making something.
It's all creative. You know, somebody needs to write those budgets. Someone needs to design those sets.
Well, when you're really lucky,
scout those locations.
You totally. And when you're really lucky, you get to partner with people that are exceptional at what they do, and they love the parts of the process that you don't. They get super excited about the logistics and about the budgets, and that's where they live. That's where their expertise is. And that's one of the wonderful parts of working in a collaborative art where you really are getting to take advantage of all these other people's incredible skills.
My name is Donna Sanders. I'm a recent graduate of Columbia University and an aspiring playwright. Listening to this thoughtful dialogue between Laura and Mia, I'm reminded of the subtle and powerful ways in which well-written stories can telescope our lives. Like Laura, I too believe that the arts can offer us a unique, transformative opportunity to experience different places, personalities, and modes of being. There's a popular aphorism, often attributed to George R.R. Martin, which claims the reader lives 1,000 lives before he dies, while those who never read live only once. On the most fundamental level, reading, attending plays, and watching television dramas give us scope and material for great acts of self-projection. I think sometimes that the mark of a truly successful narrative is a rich and effortlessly immersive world space. For me, there's nothing more thrilling than to dwell for a time within the chapters of a novel or the episodes of a series. But there are other ways, too, in which storytelling distinguishes itself as a connective art form. Laura mentioned in the interview that it takes many different artists across many different disciplines to produce a self-sustaining show in any medium. This experience of making art collectively gives each collaborator the opportunity to live in some of their fellow collaborators' shoes. The playwright can live vicariously as a director. The actor can live as a set designer or a costume designer. By drawing different kinds of creators into conversation, art opens us up to new visions and perspectives. There is perhaps no better example to this point than the primary storyline in Three Women, Laura's recent project. This series, like the book before it, dramatizes the connections that artistry can forge by centralizing an author and her subjects. The author is quite literally catapulted into the lives of these three strangers by the act of artistic creation. Her book propels her to experience life and other people in ways she never has before. I often think that the work playwrights do has the potential to make us wiser and more empathetic beings. It is only too false to say that writers lead lonely, solitary, or antisocial lives. On the contrary, writing is a supremely social activity that encourages everyone, writer and readers alike, to step back and reflect on the societies and cultural conditions that bind us all together. There is something philosophic about this notion, admittedly, but also, I think, something very truthful. Now, back to the interview.
I believe that we should say you've adapted many classic novels for the stage.
Yes.
How can you tell if a novel will function well in a play format? Do you prefer to adapt novels that you consider nearly perfect or novels with interesting structural flaws?
Oh, that is such a good question. I think it's very hard to adapt works that are considered perfect are considered to be masterpieces because there's less flexibility in terms of what you can do in the adaptation, or you can feel the pressure that you don't have as much flexibility because people are very attached to what it is in its novel form. So I found it exciting to adapt slightly lesser known work, or just be prepared that when you're adapting something that people think is perfect or is held up as one of the great American novels, that when you do an adaptation, it's your version. It's your voice added to the choir of the many people that have a relationship to that text and the openness of people in response to what you uniquely are going to bring to your version of it may vary depending on how beloved the short story is or the novel is. But I really enjoyed both. And I've also worked with other living writers and I've adapted two short story collections, one by Stuart Dybeck, one by Elizabeth Crane. And that was a great joy to get to work with living writers who were not involved in the adaptation, but were around and would come to rehearsal and were beautifully open to what I was doing with my interpretation of their work. So yeah, it's a bit of a mixed bag. I think the benefit of picking something that is considered a masterwork is that you're building on unbelievable material. So there's a great advantage there. But there's also the challenge of, this isn't always the case, but often when you're doing adaptation, you're trying to match the voice. And you always have to write something new. There's always a moment where you have to write a new scene or new lines. Transition, there's always some invention involved. So then there's a moment where you're like, okay, I have to come up with writing that matches seamlessly the brilliance of Edith Wharton or Charles Dickens or Mark Twain, all of whom I've adapted. And that can also be a beautiful, humbling challenge. But I also will say I've learned so much. Like, I've learned so much about writing character from Charles Dickens because I've been in so deeply in his work. And see how he constructs characters, see how he uses language. I learned so much about writing comedy. I don't really write comedies, but injecting comedy into my work through adapting Twain, you know, his social commentary and how that works in his work. So I also feel like adaptation has been the most incredible education for me as a writer, is to be able to not just read the work of these writers, but get so inside of the text in the adaptation process that you really are breaking things down to a sentence, to the sentence structure, the word choice. You're really deconstructing it in a way that you know, it's like you're taking the clock apart to see how it all works. And I benefited so much from that experience.
You know, it's really interesting. And I think we have other friends in common. I don't know Stuart Dybeck so well, but I know others who've adapted his work, because obviously the Chicago scene.
Yeah.
And
he's wonderful.
You have a living author, then you have that. You can ask them, but then there's also that pressure because you have to put them out of the mind. You know, now this is my story. It's no longer your story. This is now.
Yeah.
You had your part, unless it's like what you did with Three Women, or, you know, where it's more they're collaborating on the actual show as well. So do you approach collaborative writing projects differently than purely independent projects when working on a show with multiple writers? How do you balance your unique style against the larger collective vision?
Well, TV is very collaborative because that collaborative process happens very early on. The pilot is usually written when you go into the writer's room, but most of the rest of the season is not. So that collaboration starts very, very early. And that's really different from my playwriting and often my screenwriting, where I will do a whole draft of something, several drafts, and then the process is getting thoughts and feedbacks and notes, but then I go back alone into my room and that process continues until you're in production. Whereas in TV, you're really building it with the other people and taking their input and the ideas right away. So in terms of balancing, the jobs are just kind of different. And I'm still being led by my own taste, my own instinct, my own judgment about what's best for the bigger picture of the project. But the processes are just different. And at the end of the day, I'm still trusting my voice or trusting that I know the voice of the show, if I'm the showrunner, to make decisions. But there is something about doing multiple kinds of writing because it allows you to sit differently in the process. So, for example, when I was a staff writer and my job really was to serve at the pleasure of the showrunner and really put stuff on the table for them, but really trying to serve their voice, it was wonderful for me to be able to go and be a playwright in a room where every word of the text is sacred and no one gets to change a single word of a play without the playwright's approval. So that was a fun balance to be able to have those two things happen at the same time as a balance in terms of where your voice is sitting. So, yeah, I think I just kind of know the rules of the game going into each different situation. But I always have a play going. I always have a TV project going. I always have a feature going because I like the different ways as a writer you sit in the process in terms of the collaboration.
Oh, yeah, I think that's so important too. I mean, I don't normally like to talk about me, but I write and obviously I have these conversations. I think it's really important. And some people do this by switching between, you know, fiction or nonfiction or plays or, you know, television. It keeps you kind of alive and kind of in that first phase of like why you fell in love with the medium.
Yeah.
Instead of getting stuck and like, oh, this is a job.
Yeah.
It's always going to be a job. It's like we have to keep it fresh. So,
yes.
And then, of course, the collaboration. You're so lucky. You get to collaborate with so many people.
Oh, it's the best.
It's different painting.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's one of the reasons I started my career as an actor. And I was an actor for a long time, even though I started writing in junior high school. And I knew ultimately that's what I wanted to do. But I didn't want to be alone in my room. I wanted to be at the party with everybody. So it took me quite a while to finally make the time to sit down and start writing and spend the time alone. And ultimately, with the work that I do, I write alone for a while, but then I do get to be with the group. And the goal is to eventually be in a collaborative environment to actually have the thing come to fruition. But it's hard. It's hard to be alone in your room with your art sometimes. And it's a great pleasure. My favorite thing is being in the television writer's room. There's nothing I really love more.
That's great because you can see back and you can find out where it's working because otherwise it's the echo chamber of your own thoughts.
Yeah. And also I would say, you know, the thing I love is when we as a group, as a collective, build something unique that no one of us alone could have done, where we're really building on each other's ideas and sensibilities to make this very unique thing that we make collectively. That I love. I love when, oh, I have this idea. Oh, yes, let me build on that. Oh, let me build on that. And then you together have made this thing that none of you could have made alone. Those are just my very favorite days in the writer's room. Just love that.
Well, that is, you're building a whole world because some people are great at creating the engines of plot and they're just like endless. And then there's visual storytelling. So you have all these voices.
Yes.
I'm wondering, obviously, things are changing. And television, obviously, also with the advent of AI, this is changing the way people are even viewing their own creativity. I mean, I think we have to be very careful about that, but it's astonishing the things that can come out of it. I'm wondering what your reflections are just broadly about where television is now. What are your reflections on the way that that is going? I know you talked about the Writers Guild and we had this recent strike. So, you know, that there are certain protections in place. At the same time, it's very alluring and a lot of people are being tempted.
Yeah.
What would that do to our creativity?
Yeah. Well, I think there's the practical piece of it that whenever there are these advances in technology, as has always been the case, is that people and their jobs are displaced. So I worry about the human piece of it, of people losing work and being replaced. So I don't think AI is the new printing press or whatever. So this is a chronic problem that happens, but I am worried for our industry for jobs that are going to be replaced. That said, I think the benefit sort of remains to be seen. I think the thing that is most exciting to me are people's idiosyncrasies. And the large language models are, you know, you're being fed something that exists, but it's not a new idea. It's like maybe mashing up stuff that has been existing, but it's not a living, breathing human soul with all of its complications and complexities. And I just don't think that that thing will ever be able to replace the spirit. I mean, not to get too existential, but, you know, when someone dies, the body is there, the spirit is gone, and that is no longer the same thing. And to me, the AI feels like the body. It feels like it doesn't have the life spirit that humanity will bring to art. So it maybe will be a good carbon copy for certain people, but it's never going to be the like hot burning flame that humanity and a human soul will bring to art. So I think it'll be great. You know, I'll have a book that I'll be sent and that I'm adapting, and I can say, hey, do chapter summaries for me, AI, so that as I'm doing my adaptation, I can quick check chapter 12 and just like remember if there's a detail I'm forgetting. But I just don't think it's ever going to make something that's truly great or inspired or new. So I think there's plenty that it can do. And maybe with some of the visuals, there's potentially a world where we don't have to go shoot Nebraska, where you can just tell the computer what you want it all to look like. Again, I don't know how that's going to feel. I don't know if it's going to have the same kind of carbon copy, but not essentially the same, because it's not the actual place. And of course, I worry about AI being fed the same biases and prejudice and short-sightedness that exists in humanity, and then beginning to just reflect that, feeding back entrenched ideas and not living to a new place. But like everything and like all technology, I think there's probably huge pros and huge cons.
Yeah, I actually worry about the way humans use it. And not everyone thinks about, you know, AI, you know, the doomsday Terminator stories or whatever. But I mean, obviously, there are some checks in place on that with the guardrails. But people who didn't have to do this long apprenticeship, like you've come, you really learned all the aspects of your art. And some people think if they write a tiny prompt and it brings you back a fake Shakespeare sonnet, that they did that. They didn't do that.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right.
And but some of them are kind of deluded. It is plagiarism. So you need to take the time. And you do have to double check those summaries and things, because I've noticed I can't rely on it, because the thing that it chose not to delete was like, oh, this journalist who's credited with saving all these hundreds, thousands of lives who is reporting in Darfur, that was deleted. That was considered inessential. I'm like, yeah, that's the lead.
Yes. Yeah.
So that was considered, oh, I don't know, inessential.
Yeah.
It multiplies human mistakes. I want to ask you, you know, Three Women is a story of journeys. You have wonderful landscapes. You know, that is Gia's self-exploration, just stunning landscapes. She's talk about things you can't recreate with AI. Perhaps you could share some reflections of that, the filming of that, or those memories of how being connected to nature, the beauty of one of the natural world, how does that connect you with your imagination?
Sure. Episode 5 is basically a little road movie where our character Gia, the journalist, goes on the road across America to try and find subjects for her book. And we took the whole crew to Moab and to Whitefish near Glacier National Park in Montana. So I was able to go to those two places where I'd never been before. And it's one thing to see pictures of Arches National Park and in Moab. And it's another thing to be able to be there. And I don't mean to get too woo-woo at all, but like to feel the energy of that place and how humbling it is to be in such stunning vistas and those colors change as the sun sets. It was very moving to all of us to be there. And I think it was where we ended a very long, very challenging 8-month shoot. Those 2 weeks on the road were where we ended our time together as a cast and crew. And I'll never forget them. And I think it was both the end of the journey and beautiful story and a project we all really deeply cared about. But it was also something about being in that very beautiful, kind of magical, how does this gorgeousity actually exist on Earth place? And I think being in those places can really shift you into a slightly deeper place. And when we went, a lot of us went on a hike to see Arches National Park. And on our way down, it was an eclipse that night. So it was also just, it's crazy, magical. We're coming down and the sun is like this crazy shape. And it just was this very, I don't know how else to say it. And I know people hate the word magical. So I, you know, I'm grasping to find some other way to phrase this that people won't cringe at, but it was really special. And having the opportunity to be in the actual place and feel the energy of it, I think you feel in the show, and I think it comes across through the screen, but I think we all personally were very shifted by that experience, and it's certainly something I'll never forget.
I think that is something, you capture it beautifully, but it's something, like you used to say, arches, there's something spiritual, whatever our spiritual or appreciation of the beauty of this planet that we have, is that they're like cathedrals,
yes.
You know, the earliest cathedrals.
Yes.
And it's nothing to do with our hands. Actually, that's why it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
You have to just take the time. I think the arts give us that, the sense of wonder, what can be done collectively by us. And then, you know, there's so much beauty out there that has nothing to do with us. So intelligent and it's so talented. And so we have to like learn to step back and let it do its thing.
Well, I also think it allows us to really understand that we are passing through. When you stand next to a redwood and you think of how long that tree has been growing, I live right near Prospect Park here in Brooklyn. And there are these beautiful, beautiful old growth trees and some of old Brooklyn forest that still exists in the park. And I just think, you know, these trees will endure long after I'm gone. Hopefully, if Brooklyn takes care of them and people continue to support the park. I just think about that. And I definitely thought about that when we were at Arches. We are passing through and to take as much care as we can while we're here. But I think there's something very humbling about being able to be in nature and be reminded of our mortality and to kind of humbly and more kindly move through the world because of that.
Yeah. 35,000 days, none of us will be here. I tell my students that. But your stories will remain. And that's what's so important. So thank you, Laura Eason, for inviting us into your imaginative world, the courage of your storytelling, which shines a light on women's stories and desire and explores these important issues of power, identity, intimacy, and agency. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Donna Sanders, with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Donna Sanders. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions and podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.